The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, we're almost there. There are only 15 games left in the J1 season as we record on Monday night. And, this season is close to an end. And unfortunately, all of the J1 involvement in the ACL has also come to an end as of Sunday night.
Yeah, this season has both flown by and been the longest year ever. So it's a bit weird that we're coming towards the end of it. And it's a shame that we don't get a bit more ACL action in the final, because the last three games have been fantastic football to watch, which is a little more than could be said necessarily for this round of J-League fixtures.
Yeah, quite a, some teams perhaps on the beach, I'm not sure. But there weren't an awful lot of goals to report on Saturday's J1 matches. We'll come on to those shortly, but we'll begin again, as we have done in recent weeks, with the ACL over in Qatar. And as we recorded last Monday night, Kobe had made it through to the quarterfinals, but Yokohama F. Marinos were about to play at Suwon of the K-League. And, Sam, it's a horror show, isn't it, for F. Marino's supporters. They took the lead in the 20th minute through Eric. Goodness knows how many goals ahead they could have been at half-time. But the Blue Wings hit them with a second-half sucker punch. And ultimately, F. Marinos have been bombed out 3-2.
Yeah, as usual, I think Yokohama with a masters their own downfall. They should have been 3-4-0 up at half-time, and they missed two open goals through Nakagawa and Marcos Jr. There's no excuse for them not to have scored at least one of those. They should have been home and hosed. Second half, they came out. They were very sloppy at the back. They were gifting possession away. I thought Hatanaka was at fault for at least one goal where he steps out when there's no need for it. And then the third goal that Suwon scored, I mean, poor Obi, who's had such a good start to his Marinos career after being recalled from a loan at Tochigi with a lot of penalty saves and whatnot. But for this one, he's beaten from the halfway line. He doesn't really follow the trajectory of the ball. He's just running backwards, and his only aim is to leap onto the crossbar as the ball drops in behind him. So, yeah, it was just horrible. I thought Yokohama, it's just kind of what they do. If they're on it, they can beat anyone, and the way this first half went, they should have been through very easily, but then shot themselves in the foot. And you've got to give credit to Suwon. They came in with a depleted side, really. A lot of injuries. Taggart was missing, Daniil Henry at the back. So they'd missed quite a few key players, but they put up a real good fight second half. And in the end, they were worthy winners in this tie. It was just a real shame that we couldn't consistently see the Yokohama side like the one that played against Jeonbuk in both games in the groups.
Indeed. And also featuring for Suwon was former Tosu talisman Kim Min-woo, one of my favourite J-League players of the last 8-10 years or so. Of course, he headed back to South Korea as part of his military service, and he's remained over in the K-League after completing that. So, Eric opened the scoring, and Ado Onaiwu finished it in the second-half stoppage time. But yes, F. Marinos joined FC Tokyo on an early flight home after their 3-2 loss. So Suwon advanced to face Kobe in the quarterfinals. And Vissel, somehow, Sam, they edged past Suwon on penalties after a 1-1 draw after extra time. Both goals came in the first half of the 90. Park Sang-hyuk giving the K-League side a 7th-minute lead before Kyogo Furuhashi's cheeky free kick 5 minutes before half-time. After a VAR-assisted red card for Suwon's Kim Tae-hwan restored parity and handed Vissel, Sam, a huge advantage in the game, one, quite frankly, they were unable to make the most of.
Yeah, you'd never know it was 10 versus 11 for the rest of the game. Kobe were dreadful. They barely had anything leading up to the goal. They had there's a little bit of luck, I suppose, with the way the VAR works and the referee. I mean, it was a poor refereeing performance. He booked the wrong guy to start with, giving it as a penalty when it's outside the box. So just a little bit all over the place. But it was a very good free kick from Furuhashi. But after that, it was so even. I mean, Kobe did have their chances. I mean, Douglas, I don't know what happened to him in the last two games. He couldn't hit a barn door. Right? It was just not even I could could support him or back him in any of this. Yeah, he was really poor, and Suwon had their chances as well. I thought they deserved to go through in that game. They played so well with 10 men, and Kobe, I mean, without Iniesta, obviously, is like a massive blow to them. It stops the way they're playing. There's no creativity or ability to hold possession in midfield without him, I don't think. And they did bring him on in this game. I think he came on for 7 minutes of extra time. He couldn't move. He was just there as a body, there to take a penalty, where I think he re-aggravated his fight, scoring the penalty. But at least, I mean, it got them through. It was one of the worst performances you'll see to get through a last 16 or quarter-final tie. And yeah, it's just, yeah, really poor from Kobe. But they got through, and that was all that mattered.
Indeed, indeed. So, yeah, VAR assisted Kobe on Thursday in the quarterfinal, but then Sunday's semi-final, it might be a little bit an over-exaggeration to say it descended into farce, Sam, but, I mean, ultimately, yeah, Kobe have lost in heartbreaking circumstances in the final minute of extra time, a 2-1 to Ulsan. Hotaro Yamaguchi had given them a 52nd minute lead, but with about 15 minutes to go, I think it was, wasn't it? VAR certainly reared its ugly head, and Kobe are just left to count the cost.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why it's given as a foul, but if you just look at the passage of play in normal time, Yasui makes a tackle, no one makes any complaint, no one would see it as a foul. Kobe carried on and then put the ball in the back of the net, so it looked like there was nothing wrong with it. But the way that VAR has to look into minute detail over everything, there is contact, but not much. And the whole mantra of VAR is meant to be, it's got to be clear and obvious error. That's supposed to be the rules, but there's no obvious error there. It's just a very, very harsh decision on Kobe. I mean, it's not necessarily wrong technically, but yeah, I really don't like to see that. If you're looking at that, the player himself, you can tell by his reaction to the tackle. He didn't appeal for a foul. He wasn't complaining to the referee. He just got on with the game. So I think that's a giveaway that there wasn't much up with it. So I thought, yeah, that really swung the game, obviously. When you go from, we would have been 2-0 up, and then a couple of minutes later, through their own VAR-assisted goal, Ulsan equalise, it completely changes the game. And yeah, it's really unfortunate for Kobe, who I thought performed a lot better in this game. They performed like a team that deserved to be where they were in the tournament, when coming into the game they definitely didn't. So yeah, it's a real shame for Kobe, and the way it ended as well. It was poor Maekawa with the just the mistake that he'd made some fantastic saves in this game. I don't know if you've seen the header from Bjorn Jonsson, and it's past Maekawa, and somehow he gets a hand to it and claws it out. It's one of the better saves I've seen all year from anyone. It was a fantastic save from him. But yeah, late into extra time, there's a ball over the top. He should claim it. He does claim it and then drops it, kind of wraps himself around the striker and concedes the penalty. Yeah, and in the end, that cost Kobe, but it's such a shame for Maekawa.
Yes, well, I mean, at any time of the game, to concede a penalty in those sort of circumstances, a ball that, you know, he would catch 99 times out of 100, and then, but yeah, for it to be in, like, the second to last minute of extra time with the game heading for penalties is, a real heartbreaker for Kobe and for Daya Maekawa. Yeah, a real shame, as you say, Sam. Very impressive saves in this game. To keep Kobe in it, to keep them ahead, and then to keep them in it as the end of extra time approached. But then, what can you say? Just an error in concentration. As you say, he's just got to be claiming that. I mean, every single time. And, we saw Kim Sung-gyu make a pretty routine handling error for Kashiwa last week, didn't we? And it's just one of those where what can you put it down to? A tired mind. He's obviously, he's exerted a lot of energy in very trying conditions. And then, ultimately a ball that he should claim in his sleep is sending Kobe home.
Yeah, it's just a lack of concentration, and he'd been on it all game. He'd had a wonderful game. He'd had one of the better games that I've seen him have. He is culpable. He has some errors in him, but this one he was just so on it, and I just think maybe he was a little bit fired up. Maybe he just lost it. And any mistake as a goalkeeper will cost your team most times, and you can't afford it. And it's so, it's just unfortunate. He was devastated at the final whistle, as you can imagine. He'll be running that through his mind, I think, for the next couple of months. So, yeah, it's just really gutting for him.
And Vissel, quite close, Sam, to becoming the best club in Asia, which has been their obviously their target for the last couple of years, and we ridiculed them for it not from time to time, on a very regular basis, let's be honest. And, it was almost within touching distance, wasn't it? And you probably would have got pretty long odds at the start of the competition of Kobe going the furthest of the three J1 clubs. Obviously, Yokohama were extremely well fancied, but we saw their Jekyll and Hyde nature in their round of 16 game. So ultimately, it'll obviously take Maekawa and his teammates a long time to get over this particular the manner of their defeat, I suppose. Ultimately, their first crack at the ACL and making it to the last four. I mean, I guess you while some of the performances did certainly leave a lot to be desired, the Suwon one in particular, I guess we do have to give them an enormous amount of credit for making it this far and literally a minute away from penalties for a chance to make it to the final.
Yeah, they were very close. It's difficult to really sum up their campaign because I don't know, before the lockdown and whatnot, they started well, they'd got two good victories. They came to Qatar, the first game, very good performance against Guangzhou. It was a Guangzhou team without Paulinho, without their best player, so it was difficult necessarily to say that was a really exciting victory and a really good one. But then they were terrible in the reverse fixture against them. They were poor in the group game against Suwon. Dreadful in the last 16. So it's hard to say this is a fully positive. It would have been a bit of daylight robbery, I think, for them to have gone all the way. Even in this game, I think Ulsan were the better team. And you've got to look at Kobe. They've spent a lot of money. They should be competing at the top of Asia. It shouldn't be that they're a plucky underdog that's just got through. They've got so many good players. So I think they're still a way away from being this number one team in Asia, at least on the pitch. I know it's like more of an aim than necessarily a realism or something. They're definitely expanding their brand, which I think this has helped with. It's got them onto the main stage in continental football. Iniesta obviously playing and scoring goals is great for them and their profile, but they just need to be a bit more consistent. And next season, I think, is a massive season for Kobe. They've got to get their managerial appointment right, because I assume Miura's not going to be there. They've got to get their signings right. I know they're looking at a Senegalese striker from Galatasaray, but they've got to get those right. They've got to have a consistent league campaign first. Because they've flattered to see for the last 3 or 4 years in the league. They just look like a mid-table team. So I want them to improve in Japan first, and then maybe a couple of years' time they might have another crack at Asia and might be a slightly better place to go all the way.
All right, very well said. Very well said indeed, Sam. So that's it for the J1 clubs in the ACL, and all that's left now is for Ulsan to face Persepolis of Iran in Saturday's final. So good luck to both of those teams, and may the best team win. All right then, well, let's switch our attention back to J1 and a little bit of housekeeping. There was one game played last midweek, the final game that has to be made up due to COVID-19 related postponements. It took place at Hitachi Dai, and Kashiwa Reysol, the hosts, drew 1-1 with Oita Trinita. Hiroto Goya scored Reysol's goal 2 minutes into the second half, and Tomoki Iwata, perhaps smarting after not getting the Oita Player of the Season award, Sam, in last week's episode, well, he showed us what he's capable of with the equaliser for Trinita 6 minutes from time. But the Reysol Player of the Season, Michael Olunga's left foot, was left on the bench until the 85th minute, along with the rest of Olunga's body. He made a late appearance but was unable to add to his swashbuckling campaign so far this year, Sam. So anything to glean from that game? As we said, Olunga was left on the bench, so a lot of the home fans will have been a little bit disappointed not to see him from the start. But another late season runabout for these two teams.
Yeah, it was one where Kashiwa have put in a lot of effort, and since they've come back from their own COVID break and playing these extra games, they've pretty much named the same team each game. So this one, now they were out of contention, they made a few changes. They didn't really click as well as they could have done. Oita also made a lot of changes, so it was just kind of a run-of-the-mill end-of-the-season game, which, it wasn't anything that you'd have to go back and watch, I don't think.
Rightio then. So to Saturday's seven games then, and we had Johnny Nicol on last week's episode, Sam, and we knew that Gumba Osaka were off this weekend, but I think Johnny and all other Gumba supporters were able to sit back, twiddle their thumbs, and at the end of the day, they've ended up laughing like crazy after both Nagoya and Cerezo Osaka, who had a chance to put real pressure on Gumba in the battle for second. In fact, Grampus could have gone above Gumba on goal difference had they won. Both of those two teams drew 0-0 at home against, opponents on, any day they would expect to beat when, something so important as a second spot and a berth in the Emperor's Cup semi-final is on the line. We will begin at the Mizuho, which played host to Grampus for the final time in their 28-year history at Mizuho. That's the ground has been closed for renovations. So, obviously Grampus hoped to go out of that ground in style, but ultimately, Sam, they've been left frustrated. Just frankly, some absolutely unbelievable officiating here. I mean, obviously, a lot of the game took place and there was action at both ends of the pitch. Yuji Rokutan and Mitch Langerak both making terrific saves. But this game basically hinged on what happened in the 79th minute and after. Another chapter in our book of, frankly, head-scratching J-League officiating from 2020.
Yeah, I don't really understand what went on here. That obviously there's a handball that's given, the referee 10 yards away, unobstructed view, gives a penalty. You can look at the replay and you think, oh, maybe it's a little bit harsh, his hands by his side, but yeah, you can see why it's given. And then the linesman, not the one covering that half of the pitch, but the one over on the halfway line, calls the referee over, and for some reason he thinks he's got the best view of everyone, even though that's absolutely impossible. He says to the referee that you've got to reverse your decision, and then the decision changes. It's just ridiculous. I don't have a clue how the other linesman can have the authority necessarily or anything to overturn this decision. It's so random. It doesn't make any sense to me. The referee, even if he's told by this linesman, has to say, well, how do you know? And stick with your decision.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he changes his mind, and it's quite baffling how the linesman has managed to come to this decision and be so certain that the referee has made a mistake. It was just, another really weird episode in refereeing in the J-League.
Yeah, it's absolutely mind-boggling, isn't it? So, basically, listeners, in the 79th minute, Jao Schmidt heads down from Gabriel Xavier's cross from the right, and the ball struck Yokohama FC captain Masakazu Tashiro in the midriff, but also, made contact with his arm. As Sam said, his arm was by his side, but the referee, Akihiko Ikeuchi, is literally 10 metres away with, as Sam said, an unobstructed view. And after a second to consider his decision, he blows his whistle and points to the spot. Obviously, the Yokohama FC players are upset about that, but that usually is what happens when a decision like that is made. And then, suddenly the referee looks over. Well, he's alerted by some Yokohama FC players, I think, that the linesman on the halfway line has his flag up and wants a word. So, Sam, the conspiracy theorist in me is wondering if the linesman, and you don't know the answer to this, but we can speculate all we like, obviously, if the linesman has had a word from the fourth official sitting pitch side, who may or may not have access to a monitor, that maybe the fourth official here is the one really instructing the linesman to grab the referee's attention. This is something that we had mentioned a couple of months ago, I think. That Ange Postecoglou had made some pretty noted comments to a fourth official that he knows what he knows what he's up to. So perhaps this might be a thing in the J-League, where managers are aware of things like this happening between the fourth official and the officiating crew, when, of course, they shouldn't be, because VAR is not introduced yet into J1. So, I reckon the linesman might have got a word. That's basically the only reason I can come up with why the linesman would, consider overruling the referee who was 40 yards closer to the action than he was.
Yeah, I think it's very possible. He's next to the fourth official when he calls him over. Very easily, I think, someone has spotted on the monitor, or maybe it's more of the midriff than it is the hand, and advised a decision. As you mentioned, it's happened before. There was the Postecoglou one. There was one a couple of weeks ago where Sapporo got a penalty, which was only given after the same linesman next to the fourth official had a word with the referee. There was one, not last season, I think the season before, where I think it was a Yokohama goal they'd scored. It was a handball from Nakagawa, and then someone in the media room or something had said, wait, it's handball, you should rule it out. So he tried to rule it out and then went back and thought, okay, I do actually have to stick with my on-field decisions. I can't use this. So it's not like they're not against trying to get around the lack of VAR to make decisions. So, yeah, it's a bit weird the way it's come around. I guess we won't have this problem next year when VAR actually comes in legitimately. But, yeah, if that has happened, I'd be interested to see the J-League judge replay on this incident and what they decide has happened, because there can't be any backing for a legitimate call from the linesman from that distance. And, yeah, I think if there is any sort of looking at the monitor from the fourth official or anyone, I think they have to be punished for it. I think it's, yeah, completely against the way that the game is played currently with the rules without the VAR, and it's not really acceptable.
Yeah, I reckon. And I reckon that Judge Replay Show could just about be its own 24/7 channel on DAZN these days. I mean, there's so many ridiculous decisions in recent weeks in J1, and you know, obviously it spreads. It's not exclusive to J1. There are ropey decisions in J2 and J3 as well. But yeah, so well then, obviously that took a few minutes to hardly calm down. The Nagoya players weren't calm down at all, Sam, because about 3 minutes after the penalty and then the non-awarding of the penalty, Gabriel Xavier was sent off for kicking out at Yutaro Hakamata as they chased a ball into the box. For me, it looked quite harsh. I mean, the ball is away, there's no doubt, and Xavier is, as I say, kicking out in frustration, I think, and I was very surprised to see the red card brandish. I don't know what you thought, whether you thought that was justified or not.
I think with the emotion that was around it, I think there was something was always going to kick off. And when the referee has seen him kick out, I think a red card was always going to be given. I think because the ball's not really there for him to win. It's a petulant one. It's not necessarily a violent flick of the foot, but it is a kick out. So I think technically he has to send him off. And it's not really the first time that Xavier has been guilty of a frustrated kick out that's got himself sent off. So, yeah, I think he just didn't control his emotions. He had to do a little bit better there from a professional standpoint. And, yeah, he didn't. So I think probably, in my opinion, deserved to be sent off, as harsh as it probably looks.
Yeah, no, fair enough then. All right, and that came on the occasion of Xavier having a small pre-game ceremony to mark his 100th game in the J-League. I think that was in Nagoya's previous league game, and this was done in the home game that followed. But, so it wasn't a great way to end his season, his league season anyway, as obviously he'll be suspended for Nagoya's final game in Match Day 34 this coming Saturday. And as we said at the start of the intro of this game, yeah, the final game at Mizuho after 28 years has ultimately ended in frustration for Grampus. As I said, they had the chance to move above Gamba on goal difference, but instead they're now 2 points behind, having played a game more. And Cerezo also blew their chance to put real pressure on Gamba in the battle for second. They were held at 0-0 at home by Kashiwa, the league's busiest team these days. They've obviously been playing midweek and weekend for the last few weeks as they catch up on their COVID-19 related postponements. Another slightly controversial refereeing decision early on here, Sam. Michael Olunga was clattered by Kim Jin-hyun after running onto a ball over the top from Cristiano and dinking the keeper. To say he impeded Olunga's progress is a massive understatement. As I said, he was basically knocked to the floor, Olunga. And we've seen those given. Did you think that was a penalty, or was that just an unavoidable collision once Kim had committed to come and get the ball?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't have given a penalty. I can see the argument for it, but I think Alunga kind of gets the shot away or the flick over Kim, and then they're always going to collide. I think it's just, as you say, a natural collision that would happen in a game. So I'm happy for that to not be given as a penalty. I think it would have been particularly harsh on Kim. I don't know what else he can do when he's charging out to try and block the shot. He's made an attempt to save it. He actually does get a hand to the ball.
Yeah, okay then. And then just past the half hour, Alunga's left foot shot screwed just wide. So, the Racehold Player of the Season not quite on his game this week. Shortly after that, Tatsuhiro Sakamoto shot straight at Kim Seung-gyu after a determined run through the centre. Then in the second half, Hiroshi Kiyotake and Hiroaki Okuno both fired too close to Kim. In the final seconds of stoppage time, Richardson nicked the ball off Kiyotake's bootlaces as he shaped to shoot, but ultimately in a similar vein to a Nagoya, although obviously not as controversially, Cerezo were left to rue a 0-0 home draw when they really needed a victory, Sam. Ultimately, as I said before, Gumba of just sitting back and laughing their heads off at these two results for Nagoya and Cerezo, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. The only worry Gamba would have is they'd say, oh, Yokohama played quite well against Nagoya and they've got to go and face them on Wednesday, but the results were perfect for them. I don't think necessarily that Cerezo and Nagoya are a team set up to kind of dominate games. They are wanting to play on the counter-attack a little bit more, and they're not really suited to breaking down an opposition that's happy to sit in. I think Cerezo especially, where Kashua's main aim is to sit back and then release Olunga and Cristiano and Osaka on the counter-attack. So it left Cerezo with a bit too much possession for their liking, and they didn't really know what to do with it. And they didn't really create anything that was going to test Kim. There were, as you mentioned, a couple of shots, but mainly just straight at the goalkeeper. And Kashua themselves weren't over-committing anything. They had nothing to play for. So, yeah, the game didn't really suit Cerezo, and it wasn't a massive surprise that there weren't any goals in it.
Indeed, indeed. Well, yeah, elsewhere, there were some goals in the race for the ACL places that obviously could go down to fourth if a G1 team wins the Emperor's Cup. So Kashima Antlers kept the pressure on the teams above them. Obviously, we've said previously that they can't finish any higher than third, but they're still in with a chance of that after a 2-0 home win over Shimizu. Both goals came from ISA Wada, and both came very early on inside the first 15 minutes. Wada is an interesting one for the future, I think, isn't he, for Antlers, Sam? Previously, he's kind of looked to me as the sort of player that if he doesn't have too much time to think about a chance, he's quite a good finisher. When he's given time to perhaps pick his spot, he's certainly not a particularly clinical player. But two goals are very early on here. First, stroking home the rebound after Everaldo's shot was blocked by Shimizu keeper Takuo Okubo in the fourth minute. And then 8 minutes later, Juan Alano led a counter-attack and played in Wada, who rounded Okubo and tapped home before being clattered by a covering Hwang Seok Ho. So, Wada got it off to a flyer here, and ultimately that was enough for Antlers on the afternoon.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make on Wada. I completely agree with it. That's pretty much what his career has been like so far. He's been, one acts on instinct, but not, a bit like a Theo Walcott. Can't act on when he's got time to make a decision. But he didn't really play too much at the start of the season. A lot of substitute appearances, but he's obviously been working on things in training. Last month, maybe 2 months, he's come into the side. His partnership with Everaldo is fantastic, and he looks a real striker now. The first goal is an instinct one. It's the one where he reacts a lot quicker than the Shimizu defence, which isn't necessarily difficult, but he was on hand to fire home. And then the second goal, he shows really good composure to get through round the goalkeeper. I mean, less said about Valdo's defending, the better. He just watches it go through and goes, oh, well. I think he wanted to join players like Leandro Pereira and other Brazilians who've gone home early for Christmas. I think he's pretty disappointed he's still around. So, pretty embarrassing defending, but it was a really good start from Kashima. They kind of sealed the game pretty early. They are, except for that one performance against Kashima when they lost 4-1 in that midweek, I mean, they're the form team going for these Champions League places. It might still be a little bit too late, but I don't think Cerezo will be relishing facing them on the final day.
Most definitely. All right, so yeah, just resetting again, listeners, I'll try and do this as quickly and as uncomplicatedly as possible, with some clubs having two games to play and others one. Gunma Osaka are second on 62 points, Nagoya third on 60, Cerezo 59, and Antlers 58 are currently out of the automatic ACL places, but as you said, if a J1 team wins the Emperor's Cup, then the fourth-placed J1 team will also qualify for the ACL playoffs. Okay, so Antlers won on Saturday, and the only other team to win across the seven J1 games were FC Tokyo. Their game against Hiroshima at Ajinomoto Stadium was made up from match day 31, and we billed it last week as Arthur Silva and the Kids versus San Frecce. Little did I know that there was a special rule implemented, Sam, that meant that if FC Tokyo were knocked out early of the ACL, which of course they were in the round of 16, that they would actually be able to field their first team players in this particular game. So yeah, I got a bit of a shock when I opened El Galazzo, the soccer newspaper, on Friday morning and saw the entire FC Tokyo first team as El Galazzo's predicted 11 for this game. But it turned out that the entire first 11 got a rest, basically. All that apart from Go Hatano, who has been filling in goal for Akihiro Hayashi, or he might actually be the first choice now, whichever way Kenta Hasegawa wishes to slice it. So a very, very much an FC Tokyo B team. It wasn't the Kids. We didn't see any of them. But yeah, it was a second string Tokyo side that I guess understandably took a long time to find their feet in this game, Sam. I think at the first half drinks break, DAZN had it as a 10 shots to 1 in Hiroshima's favour. San Frecce had made quite a busy start to this game, and as I say, yeah, Tokyo quite a sluggish one. But from that point in the game, I think it's fair to say it was fairly even. Again, of course, I was watching through my red and blue tinted glasses. But ultimately, it was a makeshift lineup for Tokyo, and very much a surprise scorer of their winner, the left back Hotaka Nakamura, part of the Nakamura combination who have filled in for Sei Muroya at right back this season. Well, yeah, Hotaka got the start at left back in this particular game, and yeah, just past the hour, the 65th minute, in fact, Hirotaka Mita squared across the box for Nakamura. His first touch was quite a heavy one, but his second one was blasted high into the roof of the net for his first J1 goal. So from a Tokyo perspective, after a poor start to this game, obviously it's good to return from Qatar with a victory, but I don't know, I guess Hiroshima will be frustrated. They didn't make their early dominance in this game count, and ultimately they've returned home with nothing. When they had have seen the Tokyo lineup, I guess they probably would have expected a far more comfortable game.
Yeah, they would have definitely expected an easier game. I thought they were the better team, to be honest. I thought for most of the game they had a lot of possession. They didn't really necessarily create too much. Hatano made a couple of saves. There was that one Ayama strike which deflected onto the bar, and it was a lot of attacking from San Frecce, but I thought the defending from Tokyo was very good. Sometimes a bit last ditch, but a lot of blocks or late tackles in there, but I thought they did it very well. And as you say, they grew into the game a lot more. There was the chance for Mita that they had. It was well saved by Hayashi. And yeah, as the game went on, Tokyo kind of grew into this one. They looked the better team, I think, maybe towards the end, after San Frecce had kind of run out of steam a little bit. They'd done everything that they could have. They weren't getting past, and then Tokyo took advantage. So yeah, full credit to them, because it was a Tokyo B team. I mean, I think San Frecce may have been building this up as if we're going to be playing Arthur Silva and the Kids, and it didn't happen that way. That it was kind of a late ruling, I think it was, to allow the main Tokyo players that have been in Qatar to quarantine at a place, but then still travel to the games. I think Arthur Silva might be disappointed by that, because I imagine, I don't know for certain, but I imagine he wasn't allowed to join that group who were quarantining and then going to play. So I think he might have been left out for that reason. That's just speculation on my part. But if I was Arthur Silver, I don't think I'd be subjecting myself to a couple of weeks of quarantine if I didn't have to.
Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that's obviously, yeah, the reason why, yeah, he hasn't been playing for the last few weeks, but yeah, he would have been itching to play, but yeah, I guess, yeah, he couldn't, yeah.
You know, that's what I imagine, because, yeah, going into it, you think, if you're going to pick one player that's going to play this game, it's Arthur Silver, and yeah, but he didn't turn up, so that's, yeah, that's what I imagine has happened. As I say, I'm not certain, but I thought the Tokyo team that did play, I thought they played very well, and considering not many of them had played too much football all season. They'd been away in Qatar, but like Daiki Niwa at the back, I thought he was excellent with some of the blocks he made. So, yeah, really good result for Turkey. And it was good for them to get back, give the home supporters something to cheer about after a disappointing exit in the Champions League.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So I don't know whether Arthur Silva joined Leandro Pereira, the Hiroshima striker, on a plane back to Brazil. As far as I'm aware, he's still in Japan. But, yeah, if that's the reason he wasn't able to play, then, yeah, he will have been really, really frustrated about that, because he would have been itching to get back out on the pitch. So, well, firstly, I mean, that's a bit of a shame, really, that we weren't able to see Leandro Pereira in this game, and obviously he will miss the end of the season for Sanfrecce, as he's returned to Brazil. They're a 15-goal top scorer, but an interesting... So, listeners don't really want to hear us bang on about an FC Tokyo 1-0 win, Sam, but an interesting... I don't think... Well, Cameo's probably not doing it enough justice, really. Kazuya Konno came on with just over half an hour to go, and well, we're going to give FC Tokyo's Player of the Season out later on in this episode, Sam. I'm nearly tempted to throw Konno in to our three nominations here, because he simply gave Tokyo something that they haven't had all season. A player who wants the ball, he wants to pick up the ball, and he wants to run at people. It's something I haven't seen since the heyday of Takefusa Kubo.
Yeah, well, when we were speaking at the start of the season, I think with Alex Bishop, Konno was a player that was mentioned as if he could have a really good breakout season, and he's really not been given the chance for whatever reason. And he's definitely got the quality. He's sort of a bit like, as you say, Kubo, a bit like a Nakajima who's head down. He wants to go forward. He's very positive in his play. And I think Tokyo could have done with a little bit more of that at stages this season. So hopefully this is a reminder to Hasegawa that you've got a very good player on your hands here, and he could maybe fill a void next season.
Absolutely, and yeah, thanks for pointing that out. A good spot by Alex in a much earlier episode of the podcast, much earlier on in the season. So yeah, Konno may be one to watch for 2021. As you say, Sam, didn't quite get the opportunities we would have hoped for this season. We'll move on. Three more draws. Two of them at least had some goals. Down in Kyushu, Tosu hosted the champions Kawasaki Frontale. And, the first half, a couple of chances were notable as they hit the woodwork. In the 27th minute, Riki Harakawa's 25-yard strike for the host grazed the outside of the post. Then in the 33rd minute, Rio Hotate's blast from distance cannoned back off the post for the visitors. Hatate, definitely one to watch for 2021, I think, for the champions. Then in the second half, for Shogo Taniguchi headed in Yasuto Wakizaka's inch-perfect cross from the right in the 57th minute. Shortly after, Kaoru Mitoma headed Akihiro Iyanaga's cross over the bar. But then with the 4 minutes left, Harakawa's ball into the box was deflected by Jeziel, and it sat up perfectly for Renzo Lopez to nod past Junsung Ryong. That's goals in two straight games for Lopez, and it means, Sam, that Tosu are the only team in J1 to take points off the champions, both home and away. That's quite a feather in Sagan's cap, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. They're sort of the bogey team for Kawasaki. I think three of the previous four games have been draws, nil-nils, and then add this one in as well. And it just goes to show how well Sagan have played this season. I think they're written off by everyone, myself included. I think they're definitely were they bottom maybe of my J-Prid? Yeah, but they've done a lot better. They've played very well. They've brought in a lot of youngsters. I think Harakawa, yeah, he had a very good game in this one. And I think the ball in, it sets up nicely. It's quite a, yeah, it's a little bit of good fortune for Renzo Lopez, but in the right place at the right time. And they were always in this game. It wasn't like Kawasaki were blowing them away, as they have done to a lot of teams this season. It was kind of a nip and tuck game. Yeah, Tosu definitely played their part, and I think, yeah, it's just another feather in the cap of Kim Yung-hui, who's done very well to get this Tosu team playing as well as they have done, given the lack, the financial issues there, given they missed a month or so with the COVID issues and all that sort of thing. I think they've performed admirably this season, and yeah, they were fully worthy of a point here. Kawasaki, on another day, may have got two or three goals. I think we found out what Mitoma can't do, and that's head of the ball. I think he missed two very, very simple headers. It was a bit of a 50 pence header, we might say, over here. It was just, yeah, he can't do that. Keep it on the ground, Mitoma, and you'll be fine. But, yeah, it was a pretty decent game. You go into this, usually it's a nil-nil between Tosu and Kawasaki, so I feared that. But, yeah, it was a nice end-of-season game. Both teams played their part, and, yeah, a draw in the end, a decent, fair result.
Rightio then. And, well, I guess the champions, it was to be expected, I suppose, Sam, but basically they've, well, you don't want to say they've blown their chance of setting a record, that points record that could last for 5-10 years even. But, yeah, I mean, I guess it's natural there would be a letdown, but they've won just one of their last four, haven't they? So a kind of ending with a little bit of, yeah, not quite as much wind in their sails as obviously they've had it at the high point of their campaign. And as I say, that's to be expected, I guess, in some part. But, yeah, a little bit frustrating for them that they haven't been able to finish the campaign in fifth gear.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, you want to go out and celebrate and start scoring goals and, yeah, winning comfortably, and it's not quite happened for them. It's pretty much named the same team in the last few games, and I think maybe they're just a little bit tired. It's been a long season for them. Just maybe mix it up a little bit, give a few chances to a few of the younger players who might be, yeah, just like chomping at the bit to get some game time, and it might kind of bring the performances up a little bit, bring a bit more energy to the end of the season. Because at the moment, as good as the games have been, the last two, I think, have been very good games for a neutral to watch. It's just not been Kawasaki at their best. So maybe, yeah, freshen things up for the last... Have they just got one game left? Or no, they've got two games left. So hopefully, yeah, a little bit more energy necessary for Kawasaki to end on a real high, because you don't want the season to be somewhat tarnished, not really, but somewhat tarnished by a slow end to the season.
Indeed, indeed. All right, so the other 1-1 draw, rather, was played also down in Kyushu at Oita, where Trinita hosted Sapporo. And Sam, you mentioned that Naoki Nomura would definitely have been in contention for Oita's player of the season had he been fit for more of the campaign. And he obviously took your words as inspiration, sweeping home the opener in the 23rd minute here to give the host the lead after the ball broke to him in the box. But Anderson Lopez earned Sapporo a point with a fine finish at 15 minutes from time. But it really should have been all three for Sapporo after Lopez's dinked cross deep into stoppage time was scuffed against the post by Douglas Oliveira. So, yeah, Nomura, obviously very impressive player, and we wish we could have seen more of him this season. Anderson Lopez, Sapporo's top scorer, I believe that's 9 in the league now for him. And, yeah, so Oita obviously have had a busy week, and they'll, well, yeah, ultimately they'll be glad to have gotten a point out of this game when Oliveira's missed that golden chance right at the end to win it for Sapporo.
Yeah, I mean, if 5 seconds could ever sum up a player's career at a club, it was this from Douglas Oliveira. I feel for him. He gets into loads of good positions, and generally his finishing is just all over the place, or he doesn't set himself. And just to see him tap it into the post and then end up like flat in his back, in the back of the net, yeah, it was just, yeah, it was unfortunate for him. But I thought this was a good game. I thought Sapporo, you can't really get a bad game with them the way they play, and they will give chances to the opposition. That's kind of how Oita's goal came about. I think it was a poor clearance from Suga, and then it kind of bounces around a little bit, but Nomura shows great anticipation. He's the one to react to it, and his finish is a very good finish as well. So yeah, I'm really happy to see him playing games. I think next season should be a really good year for Naoki Nomura. I think he's a fantastic player. But Sapporo, they're a team that have disappointed me this year, because there's enough quality in there that they should be challenging, I think, higher in the league. They've never got past Suzuki leaving, and it's just taken them a little while to really get going. But they're a good team. I hope the goal from Anderson Lopez, it's a good pass through to him. I think it was Fukai with the ball through, and then Anderson Lopez with a good finish at the near post. So there's things to take away for Sapporo from this game. I thought, yes, they reacted quite well to going behind, but I think next season I want to see a little bit more from them. I really think that there's the basis in that team to be back up challenging for the ACL places where they were a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to believe that they were fourth 2 years ago, isn't it, Sam? But they've slid down to 13th, and they can't say that it's not a deserved position in the table, because they just haven't been consistent enough this season. Consadole. All right, so the final game was played at Saitama Stadium. Urawa hosted Shonan. I think the best thing we can say about this game, Sam, is that our pick for Reds player of the season was justified. Shusaku Nishikawa made a couple of key stops here to keep Shonan out. While of interest to supporters of both of these teams, Reds fans got a first J1 look at young forward Hidetoshi Takeda. He was a late substitute. While for Shonan, their left wing back, Tiger Hutter, impressed, or at least from what I saw from the highlights. But I'm not sure if this game really needs that much mentioning at all. A 0-0, it doesn't flatter either side, does it?
Yeah, I'm not really sure what I can say positive about this game. I think Nishikawa did make a couple of saves. I think, as you've mentioned, with Hata there, he's been very good for the last month or so, and it's going to be needed, because I think over the weekend they've sold Toichi Suzuki. He's going to Lausanne in Switzerland, which is an interesting move for him. I think Wakasuki, I think it was, who's a young Shonan player, has also gone. He went to Switzerland at the start of this year, so quite an interesting contingent building there. And then Mitsuki Saito, great player, he's off on an 18-month loan to Rubin Kazan in Russia. So there are big moves coming for some of these young players at Shonan. I think Daiki Kaneko, I think, has been linked with Reds as well, so it's going to be interesting to how they can rebuild next season. I think they're getting their best players completely taken away from them, so it's going to be difficult with four teams relegating next season for Shonan. But they do have this ability. Their youth system is very good. They do bring through a lot of players, so they're going to have to rely on that again next season. And we saw a couple of them in this game. As Hata, as you mentioned, Ohashi came on. He looked quite lively, headed one wide, and I thought Shonan were the better team in this one. I thought Urawa, just again, there's not a lot I can say that's positive about them. Sugimoto played for the suspended Leonardo. I don't know what happened to him. After that one season at Cerezo where he looked fantastic, he's just been dreadful since moving to Reds. And I think they can't wait for this season to be over, I think.
Yeah, certainly looks that way. And 0-0 at the Saitama Stadium. And they are the seven games that took place on Saturday. All right, we will let you know, listeners, what's coming up both on Wednesday and then in Saturday's final round of games, where all 18 teams will be in action. It's been a long time since we could say that. But first, obviously, we're going to hand out four more Player of the Season awards. So we'll take a very quick break and then we'll come back and do just that. Welcome back. We just had some heated discussion in the green room as to the nominees for the next four clubs in our Players of the Season series. So we're working our way up the table. Kashiwa very cheekily rose above Hiroshima up to seventh, but we already did them last week, of course. So the first team we will pick a player from this week, Sam, is Hiroshima. We have three nominees, Hayao Kawabe, 32 appearances for him this season, and three goals from midfield, very much the string puller for Sanfrecce. Leandro Pereira, the Brazilian striker who has now departed back to Brazil for the remainder of the season. 15 goals for him in 26 appearances, of which only 19 have been starts. So his starts-to-goals ratio is very good. And indeed, he's been suspended for two other games this season. So, if he had have got his disciplinary situation under control, he might have been able to contribute a little bit more. And the third nominee is Tsukasa Morishima, a very impressive attacking midfielder for Sanfrecce. He has 5 goals this season in his 32 appearances. 27 of them have been starts. So Leandro has the big number, Sam, 15. He is the joint third highest scorer in J1 this season. So for me, again, I'm only a highlight watcher of most of the teams in J1. So for me, he would probably shade it. But I appreciate that Leandro needs people to set up goals for him. So Kawabe and Morishima play a huge part in that for Sanfrecce, I'm well aware. So where are you leaning for a Hiroshima player of the season?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to argue with you about Leandro Pereira. The numbers speak for themselves. I think he's been a fantastic signing on loan. It was from Matsumoto Yamaga, which is a weird signing for them to give away such a good player as they did. I think, yeah, he looks the part. He's got everything about him going forward. He's good aerially. He's good at holding the ball up, but then he's got a little bit of pace about him. His finishing, yeah, it's terrific. So I think he'd be a worthy winner of it. I want to give mention to the other two, though. I really like Hayao Kawabe. He's sort of one that I've followed ever since I started watching Japanese football in J2 at Jubilo Iwata, and he's kind of grown for every year. I think he just gets better and better. He has taken over the kind of role in midfield from Aoyama, in that he's the one that gets on the ball, he creates everything, he's the hub of that team. So I just, yeah, Kawabe is a fantastic footballer. I know that there had been a sniffing around of him from European teams. I think Belgium and Holland, I think, there are teams there that are looking at him, and I think he'd do very well if he did move over there. So, yeah, I think he's been fantastic. And Morishima, I think maybe he had a slightly better year last year, but he is that player that gives a bit of a rare creativity and a bit of genius about him in a Jofuku side. He's that gets in between the lines, his ability to play the ball through, he's a very clever footballer, but maybe, last year I think was slightly better for him. So I will cede to you, I will go with Leandro Pereira. I think, his goals, I don't know where Hiroshima would be without those goals, and I think they're, pretty critical to him, to Hiroshima, sorry.
Indeed, indeed. All right, so looking for some feedback on this particular award, especially from Tobias Dreiman, Stephen Packer, and other Sanfrecce supporters out there. So get in touch if you have a difference of opinion on that and Hiroshima's player of the season. Look forward to hearing from you. All right, next we'll move on to FC Tokyo. And while I admit I didn't have the idea at this time, Sam, if we had have been giving out this award 2 months after the restart, well, it wouldn't have even been a competition. We wouldn't have written Leandro's name in pencil. We would have written it in black whiteboard marker. He would have been a lay-down Mazaire for this award after he scored 6 goals in his first 10 Tokyo League appearances, but since then he's very much gone off the boil, and his temper has certainly reared its ugly head on more than five or six occasions in the remainder of the season. And ultimately, with one game to play, and we presume he'll be back for that, and most of if not the entire Tokyo first team will be back for Kobe at home on Saturday. Leandro currently sits on 9 goals, the same number of goals as Diego Oliveira, last season's top scorer, who admittedly has not been as productive as he was last season and in previous campaigns for Tokyo. Diego also had a purple patch in mid-season when he scored 5 in 8. So if you could combine Leandro's early exploits for Tokyo and Diego's mid-season, you would have had an absolutely outrageous striker, battling around for the top three places in the Golden Boot. So ultimately, I think Leandro Oliveira is going to be one nominee for FC Tokyo, but I don't think they're going to take the award. The other two nominees are Shuto Abe, the first-year midfielder for Tokyo, a box-to-box all-action midfielder, and Masato Morishige, Sam. 27 appearances for the veteran central defender, and I must admit that at the start of the season, again, if we had have thought we were going to do this award at the start of the season, I would have hoped that I would be nominating Tsuyoshi Watanabe for this award, but he hasn't quite kicked on to the level that I would have hoped, and indeed that obviously the club expects for him, letting the likes of Yuichi Maruyama go. They've put a lot of faith in Watanabe, and while he has had a steady season at times, he's prone to lapses in concentration and his work on the ball and his positional sense still needs quite a lot of work, I think. So Watanabe very much still a work in progress. So Morishige remains the anchor in central defence for Tokyo. And I guess while I've got the floor, Sam, I'm just going to give it to Shuto Abe because I absolutely love this fella. He's come in this season and really, really surprised me. 26 appearances, only 2 goals, but he's done some damage in other competitions as well. And he's been a breath of fresh air that Tokyo haven't had for quite a long time. He combines a lot of what Kento Hashimoto does and Hirotaka Mita does and Yojiro Takahagi does. He does pretty much all of it. And he's been a revelation as far as I'm concerned. And obviously, if Leandro had have continued on the form he showed early on, then he would have won this award. But for me, for consistency of excellent performances over the season, Abe wins it for me.
Yeah, completely agree with you. I think he's fantastic. We got a brief glimpse of him last season where I think he made one appearance and maybe one off the bench, and he just looked a player at that point. And then he's gone on and he's taken this bit. He runs this midfield, especially since Hashimoto left. I think he's had to carry Takahagi a little bit and Mita or whoever's played in there. I just think he's got absolutely everything. And for his first real season, to be running a midfield of a team that's played Champions League football is were for a long period challenging for ACL place. I think he's just got a little bit of everything about him. I think, yeah, gets on the ball. He doesn't give anything away. He's so, yeah, you can trust him with it. And the energy he shows is great. He gets back and defends. I think, yeah, really good player. I think you've got a little bit of a gem there that it'd be interesting to see how long you can hold on to him, because I'm sure I don't want to sell him off or anything like that. I hope he does stay at Tokyo next season. But yeah, terrific player. Just on the other ones, I thought, yeah, Morishige, I think he's Mr. Dependable at the back there. I think, yeah, you can rely on him all season. He's always in the right position. He has helped Watanabe along when Watanabe has made an error or two this season, and a little bit of the fullbacks as well. He has to cover a lot back there. There's quite a bit of responsibility on him. So I think he's had another fine season. And the other two, Leandro, yeah, fantastic start of the season. Disciplinary has cost him probably in the latter half, and the lack of form, yeah, he's kind of gone off the boil. And Diego Oliveira has been forced wide a lot this season. He's having to play right wing, where he has to do a lot more defensive work than he was last year in a 4-4-2 with Nagai, so that's hampered his goal-scoring ability. But I think he's done a very good job for the team, and it's just kind of maybe hampered his own personal numbers and statistics this year.
Yeah, that's very well said. He certainly does love to muck in Diego, and he often cops a kicking for his troubles, as we saw, obviously, in the ACL. But, a consistently good season for Diego, I would say. Leandro, obviously, hot at the start and then a little bit colder towards the end. And, well, I believe that Leandro is signing on a permanent basis from Kashima. And obviously these three Brazilians plus Arthur Silva, the three up front do seem to get along particularly well. So that's good news for Tokyo supporters. Leandro 9 and Diego 9 as well. And Adailton has 8, most of his appearances coming off the bench. So, yeah, things to build on for Tokyo next season. And, yeah, gee whiz, Sam, you're selling shit to Abe off already? God, you'll be the you'll be the death of me. But, well, that's good to know. We didn't discuss this one in the Green Room listeners, so it's good to know that I still know what I'm talking about because, yeah, for me, Abe, head and shoulders, FC Togo's player of the season. I'm glad that Sam agrees. If the FC Togo Kai guys want to weigh in, please feel free to do so. Okay, so two more teams to go on this episode. And I think they're probably almost as clear-cut as Shuto Abe is for FC Tokyo, Sam. We'll move on to Kashima next. Our two, let's do these perhaps in reverse order. We have two nominees from central midfield for Antlers. They're ever-reliable central midfield pairing of Leo Silva and Kento Misao. Misao, the club captain, made 29 appearances this season. Leo Silva, he's getting on a bit, but he's still got plenty of life in that old engine yet. 31 appearances for the veteran Brazilian. But, few players in the last 5 or 6 years have taken J1 by storm, as Everaldo has. He's really enjoyed a purple patch in the second half of this crazy season. 17 goals has him runner-up to Michael Olunga in the race for the Golden Boot. He's obviously not going to catch the Kenyan, but he's just been an absolutely fantastic addition to the Antlers attack. And as you said earlier on in the episode, Sam has forged a really impressive looking partnership towards the end of the season with ISA Wada. So I think it's absolutely going to be unanimous, isn't it? And you get a chance to wax lyrical about Everaldo, one of your favourite J-League players.
Oh, I'm glad I get to do that. He's fantastic. Considering how slowly he and Kashima started this season, for him to have gone up to 17 goals is just a credit to him. He's, as you said, he just has taken the league by storm. He looks a cut above everyone in terms of his all-round play. He can do anything. He's obviously got the aerial ability that is so, once you play against Japanese defenders, a lot of aerial threats are going to do quite well, but he's way more than that. He has got such quality on it. His finishing is superb. I've seen a lot of clips of him scoring overhead kicks in Brazil, which he hasn't managed to do yet this season, but it's going to be something we can look forward to next year. He's just got, such quality about him. He's so clever. His movement is fantastic. He's not all about goal scoring. He can drift out to either side. Some of the passes he plays are fantastic. I just think they've got a very, very good player in Everaldo, and I don't think Olunga has obviously scored a lot of goals, but I don't think anyone comes close to Everaldo in terms of ability. And I think next season, as I've said before, I think as long as he's at Kashima for the full season, I don't think anyone's stopping him being top scorer.
Absolutely brilliant. And I imagine Will Everaldo will take his place in the J1 team of the season alongside Olunga up front. And next we have Cerezo Osaka, the last team we'll do on this week's episode, which leaves us with three to cover on next week's episode as we wrap up the J1 season. The nominees for Cerezo Osaka, well, two of them are very familiar, and at the start of the season, if you were putting a short list together for an award like this, you most definitely would have put Mate Jonic and Hiroshi Kiyotake on it. Jonic ended up with because they've still got two games to play, sorry. Yeah, he has been ever present this season, 32 appearances for the central defender, and Kiyotake has missed just one game. He's played in 31 games and scored 8 goals. The third nominee, you probably wouldn't have had him on your shortlist before the 2020 campaign kicked off, but Tatsuhiro Sakamoto has been, a breath of fresh air for Cerezo. Earlier on in the campaign, Sam, we were mentioning him pretty much on a week-to-week basis along the lines of Kaoru Mitoma and Yusuke Matsuo. He's gone off the boil, I guess, a little bit in the second half of the season, perhaps, feeling the tiredness, perhaps, of his first ever J1 campaign, and especially with it being so truncated. But I think, well, Sakamoto deserves his mention here as one of the three best players this season for Cerezo, but he's probably he's not quite going to make the final reckoning, is he?
No, I don't think so. I think if he'd somehow managed to keep that form going, then he'd been right up there for it. But yeah, he just faded off a little bit. I mean, it's a difficult season for anyone to maintain their levels of performance, especially a player playing in J1 for the first time. But yeah, he was incredible for the first probably two-thirds of the season. He didn't really arrive with much fanfare from Yamagata. I think he was seen as a good player for Yamagata, but I didn't really see anyone saying this player is going to light up the league in the way that maybe we would have with Kamiya and Nakama, who went to Kashiwa. I think the focus was more on them, and he's come in and he's been, yeah, terrific. The work that he and Kiyotake have done on the wings, everything that, especially start of the season, everything was coming between those two, and more often than not, Sakamoto. His deliveries for Bruno Mendes were fantastic. He's got quality on the ball. He dribbles past defenders. Just, yeah, he was fantastic, and we were looking at him as in the same vein, as you said, as Mitoma. So I think terrific season for him to establish himself as one of the best players at what have been one of the best teams in the league is full credit to him. And yeah, he definitely deserves his mention.
Indeed. Well, yes, Cerezo have spent a large part of the season in second, haven't they? They're the closest contender to Kawasaki, although they were obviously a fair way off the pace. It's basically been Cerezo and FC Tokyo for a short time and then Gumba for the last bit of the season. So I guess overall, Cerezo haven't been quite as effective defensively, at least in terms of goals against column, as they were in 2019. But Jonic has been effective again, and yeah, definitely deserves his mention here.
Yeah, last season I think he was the absolute shoo-in as the best player for Cerezo. I thought last season, just he was imperious at the back, and there have been a few chinks in the armour this year. I think the Seko and Kimoto were his two centre-back partnerships who have switched around a little bit, and I don't think they've necessarily come on as much as, well, in Seko's case, as much as Lotina would have wanted. So Jonic has had to cover a little bit. He's been caught out a few times. There was that period when they lost to Kawasaki 5-0, and was it 5-0? Whatever, they conceded 5 goals, and they looked a bit shaky there, and then they went on a patch where, yeah, he wasn't quite on it as much as he has been, but that was only a short period of time. But for the rest of the season, he has been fantastic, as he always is. He's a threat in the opposition box, and he's just the one. You know that if you're coming up against Matej Jonic as a striker, you're going to have a very tough day to get past him. So I don't think I can say anything more positive than that. I think, yeah, he's one of the best defenders I've seen in the league in the last few years. But again, I wouldn't necessarily give him the overall award for Cerezo, as good a player as he is.
Indeed, indeed. And I mean, yeah, you could you could obviously argue Sakamoto deserves to be higher on the podium than Jonic, and that's I guess that's a matter of personal preference. I think in the green room, Sam, actually, you said you probably preferred Sakamoto's season as a whole to Jonic's, but yeah, either or. But I think we're going to be unanimous in our decision here that Hiroshi Kiyotake back to his best basically this season. It's been great to see him avoiding injury this year and basically get a full campaign in. And well, yeah, he would love those last 10 seconds back against Kashiwa on Saturday. He'd love to be able to shift the ball a little bit further out of Richardson's reach and, yeah, to be able to get his shot away and to attempt to win that game for his beloved Cerezo. But, yeah, ultimately, as I say, Sam, it's just been great to see him back and, yeah, back to his best.
Yeah, that's the main thing for me, because everyone knows how good Hiroshi Kiyotake is. But since he's come back to Cerezo, it's just been plagued with so many injuries. And it's just weird, in a way, that this season of all seasons, when he's had to play every 3 or 4 days, that he's managed to keep himself fit and not get injured. As you said, there was only the one game he didn't play. So, and his quality has just been there every game. He's not drifted out of games, as he has done occasionally in previous seasons. He's always been the go-to guy for Cerezo. If they're every attack, it seems to go through him. He can play out on the wing, he cuts inside, he can then play in the hole. I just think, yeah, his quality is so far and away above the rest of that Cerezo team. And you can tell, if he isn't playing, I don't know where. I know Sakamoto has done very well, but you'd fear for them if Kiyotake wasn't there. And I just think he's, he has goals to his game. He's just, I just love Kiyotake. I just think there was, I just remember to that World Cup qualifying campaign where Kiyotake was Japan's best player, and then he's just got injured and then dropped out of contention. He's not played for Japan since. And I thought that was such a shame. But to get Kiyotake back playing at this level has been one of my highlights of the season. So, yeah, I couldn't put anyone above Kiyotake for Cerezo.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And, well, hopefully he'll be lighting up the ACL as well as a J1 next season. So congratulations to Hiroshi Kiyotake, to Everaldo, Shuto Abe, and to Leandro Pereira for joining our previous winners of their particular club's J-Talk Players of the Season Award. Fantastic. That leaves us with three clubs to do on next week's episode. In some particular order, it'll be Nagoya and Gamba, depending where they finish. It's either second or third, or, well, obviously Grampus could finish fourth, but we'll wait and see. And then the big one, we have to pick a name as Kawasaki's Player of the Year, Sam, and it should be interesting. If any listeners want to weigh in the meantime and try and sway our opinions, they're more than welcome to do so. So, yeah, that's all to come in next week's episode, in which we'll also obviously be reviewing the final days of the J1 season. As I said right back at the start of the episode, only 15 games left to be played before all is said and done. On Wednesday, six games from match day 33 will be played in the race for second. Gamba Osaka visit Yokohama FC, who obviously just held Nagoya away, so it'll be interesting to see what happens at Mitsuzawa. And Cerezo Osaka are at home again. They will face Tosu, who have been very entertaining in the last few weeks, so that'll be a very interesting clash at the Yanmar Stadium. Another game that I picked out is Kawasaki versus Urawa. Obviously, Frontale playing their final home game of the season at Todoroki, and they'll look to go out in style against Reds. And, well, yeah, as Sam said earlier, it looks like most Reds players just want this season to be over and done with. And if Kawasaki are in the mood on Wednesday night, rather, well, then goodness knows what could happen. But, well, Reds have put in decent performances here and there, so perhaps they will on Wednesday. Who's to know? And then have I been saying the final match days on Saturday or Sunday, Sam? Because I think it is on Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah, it is Saturday.
Yes, rightio. So all nine games kick off at 2 o'clock. Again, in the race for second, Gamba Osaka host Shimizu, and Nagoya are at home against Hiroshima. And, well, yeah, the big one in this is the battle for the ACL spots is Kashima hosting Cerezo, as we mentioned earlier on. That should be an absolute cracker. Also on Saturday, Kashiwa hosts the champions. FC Tokyo entertain Kobe. There's a Yokohama derby at Mitsuzawa when the Yokohama FC host Yokohama F. Marinos are back from Qatar. A battle of the bottom, if you like, when the Sendai, who are 18th and bottom, host a 16th place Shonan. And in the final two games, Urawa hosts Sapporo. And a Kyushu derby will finish us off as a Tosu host Oita. So, Sam, yeah, as we said right back at the start, it's just hard to believe, isn't it? We've just been churning out match day after match day, and, come Saturday afternoon, it's going to be all over, and I think we're going to really be feeling some Stockholm Syndrome here, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I have no idea what's going to be happening. I don't know what I'll be doing when I'm not reviewing a Japanese game or a match day or whatever we were doing at the start of the season or in lockdown with churning out those podcasts. So, yeah, it's been a quite crazy year, and it's going to be very weird when it's over.
Yeah. I think we're just going to have to continue to do podcasts every week, even though there's nothing happening and there's no news, because we've just gotten into the routine of doing it for so long. But, that's to be discussed. Obviously, I have to get in touch with your agent and see if you're available. But, so there we go. Pretty happy with those four players of the year, Sam. I think we've done it all in a very cordial manner. And, we'll leave it there. And, enjoy the last few days of the J1 season. We will we'll do it all again next week. And then, we'll figure out what we're going to do after that.
Yeah, look forward to wrapping everything up with you next week. It should be, especially that Cerezo Kashima game should be a terrific game. I really hope as a neutral that they're definitely, like, Cerezo haven't won in midweek and then, yeah, they haven't ruled Kashima out of contention.
All right, now, this is a bit rude of me, but I used to always put John and Stuart on the spot with predictions when they're on the when they're on the monthly J2 specials. It's a bit rude of me to do absolutely without notice, but, basically, who's going to finish second in J1, Sam?
Gamba, I think, will finish second.
Okay, fair enough. I would.
Yeah, that was easier than I imagined.
There you go. That wasn't too bad, was it? Okay. Yeah, I would concur. So we'll wait and see. Hopefully, that's not the kiss of death for Johnny Nickel and all other Gamba supporters. But yes, we'll wait and see, and we'll talk about it in next week's episode. So that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon, and of course you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up the end of the J1 season. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast.